You're listening to the world's smartest podcast network.
When I go to Sacramento, I will pump up Sacramento. Sacramento. Sacramento.
Some say the news is fake. Others say it's real. These two don't have the time to check. Instead, Turner Sparks and Michael Ira Kaplan turn to comics stationed around the globe to be their eyewitness reporters so that you can know what's really going on. This is Lost in America.
All right, everybody, welcome to Lost in America. My name's Turner Sparks.
I am Michael Kaplan. Oh boy. It's gonna be fun.
You can find me on tour. I'm going on tour. You can find me September 16th at Hyenas Comedy Club in Dallas, Texas with Andrew Heaton, the mighty Heaton. The Heaton heads will be out in force. We need the Lost in Americans to be there too to at least balance the show. Hyenas Comedy Club, Dallas, Texas, September 16th. Everybody, come to that show. I'm also going to be on. If you're not in Dallas, if you're somewhere else. Oh, we're going to be in Ardmore, Oklahoma.
Ardmore, shout out.
September 14th.
We have a lot of fans there, Ardmore. You should do two nights.
Two nights in Ardmore. Yeah. And we're going to be. And then I'm going on tour throughout the fall. I'm already starting to book January stuff. So. Things are looking big. You can find Kaplan at, and that's turnersparks.com for all my tour dates. Kaplan, you can find him, Captain America, on all social media channels. Kaplan, are you, I can't tell if you're drunk or high or what's going on right now.
So my kids are with my parents right now. And so came home and Randy was out.
Cap's loose.
Well, I came home and she was gone. And I was like, oh, she's out tonight. So then I was like, what am I going to do? I got nothing. I literally have nothing to drink in this house. I was going to drink like we have like
wait, stop. What an alcoholic excuse. Like even the faucet doesn't work. You don't have water.
I was looking for the alcohol, rubbing alcohol that we use for s'mores night. I was like going to drink that. I was like, what do we got here? We got some weird bottle of chocolate flavored whiskey someone gave me my 40th birthday. I was like, that's gross.
Do you have mouthwash? I saw a homeless guy drinking mouthwash the other day.
I've got this bottle of vodka that my nanny gave me from her country in Guyana, but I can't open it. I don't have the grip strength. It's like you got to be a real man to open it. So I can't get it open. Sure. So I've never cracked that one. So okay. I was running low and I looked in the cabinet and I was like, oh, right. There's a box of when Pancakes Kaplan, my dog, I get her CBD. I spent a lot of money on her, right? So
you took dog medication?
No. But I'm taking the long way to get to this story. But there's when you order her CBD, there's like a combo, like get human gummies and dog gummies, right? The same time.
No, really?
Yeah. So you get them both. And I've never eaten. I give her one every day. I never eat it myself. So I was like, oh, I should eat one.
Wait, you gave your dog weed every day, like edible gummies?
Every day, hemp. Yeah, she's a senior dog. She can barely. She's almost 13, which is like 90 in dog years. I mean,
does
she's,
she even know like what day it is? Does she know what's going on?
They don't normally know what day it is. They're the best. They're the best.
Pancakes. Who's the president?
She still yells out racist things when you get her. Yeah, you don't want to hear what she says about Orientals. You know, you should see it. So that's Pancakes talks.
Oh, boy.
That's Pancakes. But I decided to eat one of these gummies, right? I've never had one. I have the full container. And I was starting to open it. And again, I got the grip strength problem. And I'm like, oh, wait.
Keeps coming back.
Well, I had to get like a knife or something to crack it open. And I'm like, wait a second. There's one that's not... A friend of mine gave me one once that's not so I'm like, oh, I should eat that first. It's been here for like 2 years. At a party, he gave it to me. So it's like a chocolate one. And I was like, oh, it's like a chocolate, you know, CBD. I ate it. I ate like half of it, three quarters of it.
I mean, you're high as a kite right now.
Before I remember it, it's not CBD.
So it's just regular.
It's like hash, I think, whatever that is.
But yeah. In a gummy bear.
Oh, in a chocolate.
Oh, in a chocolate.
But then...
See, wait, can I say something? Because my wife and I have this... Yay and I have this argument all the time. She says that you don't want to take expired medicine because it doesn't have effectiveness anymore. So it's like eating nothing. But I always say, no, just take it. Something's better than nothing.
Right.
Kaplan, you're proving now. Well, this has been on your shelf for 2 years?
It's been 2.5 years, I believe. Or maybe, I don't remember the exact date of my time frame, but... And I was when I was eating it, I'm like, oh, I don't remember that night. I don't remember what day it was, but I'm like, what could it do to me, right? It's like one chocolate thing. It's like the size of like a Reese's peanut butter cup or something, you know?
Yeah.
So I ate it. And then at first, nothing happened. I'm sitting there watching the tennis. I'm having a, I poured a glass of sake. I found it in my fridge. Do you remember how when we went
You're really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
We went to Massachusetts. We had this amazing Airbnb host who like was the most like, he was like popping by. He's like, what can I get you? So he bought us all sorts of stuff. He stocked the fridge with like all sorts of kids stuff and bottles of wine and everything. We first moved in. And then when we left, I was like, in the real Jewish form, I was like, I got to take the good stuff to go. So it was a bottle of sake, a weird flavor too, that we never drank all week. And I'm like, oh, I'll take it. Maybe it'll come up. So today I saw in the fridge after I ate the chocolate. I'm
so you're drunk on sake and high on a weed chocolate closet.
So I ate it. Nothing. I felt normal. I'm drinking the sake. Randy comes home. She's got dinner. She knew I'd be home. So I had a, I microwaved myself a dinner. I started eating the dinner. She FaceTimes the kids. The kids are in Pennsylvania. They're talking to the kids right as Ruby's talking to her. All of a sudden, my brain, it was like, oh, it like hit me. Like it doesn't hit you for the first half hour, 45 minutes. Wow. All of a sudden, like, whoa, what's going on here?
And now you're toast.
And then you called me like, and then you had, you were pocket dialing me. So you called me like four times, I think.
Oh,
and I was like spinning out of my mind, and then I'm like, oh boy, I gotta do a podcast. I'm like, oh, this is gonna be fun.
And then I was like, Cap, well, let me get to some good news.
Bring it on.
Drunk and high, Cap, you're living the life of a divorced man right now. by the way,
well, or your kids go off to college. This is what happens when the kids go off to college. Anything goes. You just start getting wasted.
Is this it?
This is what happens.
Your kid, yeah, well, your kids went to the grandparents for 2 days. So anyway, let me get to the good news. Patreon.com, folks, if you want to support, if you're having a fun time listening to this podcast, and we got great feedback on the Andy Curtin episode last week, everybody loved it. If you're having a good time doing it, throw us $5 a month, throw us some money, throw us some, show us some love, let Kaplan afford to buy, you know, alcohol so he doesn't have to go get this free sake from upstate Maine.
I had a heart attack a few years ago, so I put on my, watch to monitor my heart rate because I got a little nervous about hash. Give me a
sure.
I'm at 78 right now. I think that's all right.
All right. Well, Cap, let me tell you, we have four people. We have so much action on the Patreon this week.
Wow.
First of all, I want to start with shout out to Blake Henderson. He's a friend of my brother's, Tyler Sparks. Blake Henderson came in, first time subscriber, $5 a month. Shout out to Blake. Thanks for joining.
Blake.
Thanks for joining the Pod Army. He's listening to Live from the Bunker 3 days a week, our full throttle comedy podcast. We're inadvertently giving you a taste of it right now with Drunk High Cap.
I take hash once a week for that show live.
Another shout out today. This just came in hot off the press. David Teffertiller.
Teffertiller.
You say that. You can say it high and drunk. I can't say it sober. David Teffertiller, everybody. Shout out to him. We don't have his story yet. I don't know how he joined us, but I know he did. So thank you to him. We'll have to get his story and we can introduce you all to him next week. Kaplan, now.
So we have a great, are we at our high, all time high with Patreon right now? Are we close to the party?
I think we're in an all-time high. We're over $350 a month. Very exciting. $354 a month. Kaplan,
we're
now,
a party.
Two more announcements here. Right. So, also what happened in the interim since we left you last week, Will Prechuck not only came to my show in New York City, not only introduced himself to the CPA to the pod, Gary Sparks, not only met my wife, Yaya Sparks, but also then went home and raised his subscription from $20 a month to $30 a month.
Oh, wow, thank you, Will.
We didn't even know that was possible.
You put some hash in the water there at the comedy
club. We thought 20 was as high as you could get. We don't know enough about our own business. Our customer knows he can go up to 30. We didn't even know
that.
We
haven't been asking people. Maybe they would have done it earlier if we would have told them.
So we bragged about it on the Patreon show this week on Live from the Bunker. We bragged about how Will went up to 30 a month and all these other Patreon subscribers, you're scum. You don't have $30 a month. Will's the daddy Warbucks. Well, guess what Dennis Owens did?
Oh, he went
from $20 a month to $31 a month.
Oh, it's like he went right over, $1 over. It's
he's
like we're
beating
poker
out
now.
Will Prechuck.
Well,
so
he raised
Dennis Owens
him.
Said, no, not on my pod. You know, he's used to being the king of the Patreon channel. Yeah,
yes.
And Will Prechuck upstaged him by going to 30. So Dennis Owens went to 31. Love all of you people. Thank you so much. Dennis Owens has a t-shirt on the way. For $10 a month, you get a Lost in America #1 in Armenia t-shirt. It costs us $20 to send you the t-shirt. It literally doesn't make sense. We're losing money for you on the first 7.5 weeks because we're not very good at business.
No.
But listen, $10 a month, $5 a month, you get the Patreon show. Kaplan, now, what we're doing today on the show, we're going to have a regular Lost in America episode later in the week, but today we're doing our roundtable with Professor Andrew Heaton from the Political Orphanage podcast, with Dr. Andrea Jones Roy. They both stand-up comedians, but both smart people. She's from the Ask a Political Scientist podcast, currently working on a new pod idea. And us, the four smartest people in America.
You wouldn't believe it tonight, but I am one of the four smallest people in America. Smartest people in America.
Smallest.
I am one of the four smallest. Will Pre-Chuck, go $32 now. Raise the ball, please. Come on.
Oh my God. Gary Sparks is up to get it. He's really getting shown up here.
Yeah. Dr. Bob, go to 40. My dad doesn't know how to donate to Patreon, or he would, but we'll.
Jeff Kaplan.
Come on, show him, Jeff.
Anyway, so the four smartest, it's the World Smartest Podcast Network Roundtable, everybody. Now let's get to it. On with the show.
Welcome to another roundtable discussion of the World's Smartest Podcasting Network. I'm Andrew Heaton. I'm the host of The Political Orphanage, and I am joined by Michael Kaplan and Turner Sparks, hosts of the Lost in America podcast. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello. How's it going?
Hello, Heaton.
Very well.
Yes, and I want to say up top that you and I are going to be at Hyenas Comedy Club on September 16th, co-headlining a show there in Dallas, Texas. So everybody come out to that show. September 16th, go to Hyena's website. Tickets are available now.
That is exactly that right.
That's an awesome name for a comedy club, by the way. Most comedy clubs have horrible names. I'm 100% agreed. On board with Hyenas. I'm Andrea, by the way.
Hello. That would be Andrea Jones Roy, Dr. Andrea Jones Roy, of late the host of Ask a Political Scientist and now a panelist ex officio of WSPN.
What does that mean?
World's Smartest Podcast Network.
I know what that means, but what's ex officio?
Well, because you're like on a break with your podcast.
Oh, I see. Okay. Oh. Yeah, I'll take it.
That's Heaton's vocabulary superiority to all of us.
I got flustered, so I said Latin. But I do want to highlight that. Turner, we're doing the 16th in Dallas. That's open. It's at a comedy club. If you're in Dallas, come do that. We're going to hang out afterwards. Presumably, Jennings is going to join us. For those of you that know Jennings from the program, that my former producer who sometimes does things with Snuffies, he's going to almost certainly be there. And then Turner, you and I are going to be doing a private gig in Tulsa. But we're also going to do a meetup in Tulsa on Friday the 10th. So if you're in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or within easy frisbee distance of Tulsa, stay tuned because Turner and I are going to do a meetup someplace there the 10th of September.
Yes, and Heaton, we're also going to be in Ardmore, Oklahoma, doing a show on Tuesday, September 14th. That just got added recently.
That's right. We're hitting all the major points.
Go to turnersparks.com. I have all the information up there.
The Dallas, Ardmore, Tulsa axis of comedy. We're going to be doing all those three things. So, yeah. So, if you were at Ardmore and you're like, man, that's a little too far for me to drive to Tulsa, don't worry. We'll be coming to your hometown. Cool. You guys want to talk about some topics?
Let's talk.
Sure.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I'm sorry. I was busy booking my flights to Ardmore, but now I'm
that's
back.
That's right.
They have an airport, right?
Ardmore. Yeah, of course. Yeah. They got an international terminal.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be flying in from Shanghai. So, perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. So I think I'll kick it off. I want to do something wonky and then we'll get to, actually Turner, are we talking in Afghanistan? Is that your topic? Should we start with you since that's more newsy?
My topic,
or did you go with a different one?
I went with a different one. I feel like we can talk about that, but I say, let's talk about it and move on. Cause kind of everybody's talking about it. And I think we all have the same opinion, don't we? Doesn't everyone have the same opinion that this isn't necessarily good?
The Taliban's probably learned
my
lesson.
Don't speak for me. I'm a pro Taliban.
It's awesome.
Comic.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay, good. Then we all agree. It's been a wonderful development. Yeah. So I'll kick it to something, wonky then.
Great.
And just dive into the wonk, which is the child tax credit that has been a part of Biden's economic program. There is a lot of wonk talk right now in the wonkosphere about whether or not that should be extended permanently. So right now, the way the child tax credit works, it works until December of this year. That's how long it's been authorized for families that make or for single parent families that make up to $75,000. They get $250 per kid, or $300 per small kid, but basically $250 per kid. Two-parent families of up to $150,000, same thing. So a wide amount of people are now eligible and just automatically receiving $250 per child. And
per
so,
year?
Per month.
Okay.
So it ends up being about what is it like $3,000 to $3,600? Yeah, to get the wonk fully out here, it's $300 I think up till age six, $250 from age seven or age six to 18. And there's no cap on kids either, but I did the math. You'd have to have a lot of kids before you really got wealthy off of doing
it. Well,
that.
The Orthodox Jews are going to clean up there.
That's so right, yeah.
How many kids do they usually have?
I don't know, six to eight per family or so. So, yeah.
Okay. So they can make like $20,000 to $25,000 off of that.
Exactly.
That's why they're, okay, never mind. I was going to talk about Williamsburg, but I'm going to stop.
Well, the debate that we're having right now, or that they're having, is do we expand this or not? And it's almost like this inversion of the 1996 welfare reform that we already did. So
I was just thinking that.
Yeah. So do you want to walk us through that, Andrea?
I mean, I can, but I'm very aware
that I'm monologuing right now, and so I don't want to dominate too much. So in 1996, there was bipartisan welfare reform that happened under the Clinton administration in conjunction with then Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. At the time, there was a concern that welfare was essentially broken and that it had a lot of it was causing cultural joblessness. About 9 out of 10 families that were on welfare were not working, and there was a very big concern that welfare was basically keeping them from working because they had no incentive to go out and work. So there were measures that were added to it. You couldn't be on welfare permanently. You could only be on welfare for X amount of time, and strings attached to it. You had to be applying for work while you were doing it. You had to do drug tests. You had to do things like that. And that became the 1996 welfare reform. Clinton did a big welfare reform victory lap in 2006, where he talked about how the amount of people on welfare had declined and all these different things. So we're kind of almost undoing that in one way right now, because it doesn't have any strings attached. This is not there's a kind of means testing in that you're only eligible for the money if you're at a certain point of income, but you don't have to do all of these other things going on. And so on the one hand, there's this sort of idea of, isn't this great? It's much cleaner. It's less bureaucratic. It's much more easy to access. People just get their check in the mail. On the other hand, there's a concern that it will undo the needed reforms that happened in 1996, and it will cause people to go back to not having jobs and things of that nature. So that's kind of the locus of the arguments that are going on. A couple of the things that I kicked up while doing this that I found interesting. We actually have done a decent job combating poverty the last few years. The thing that I noticed that really surprised me is that when we talk about the child poverty rate in the United States, there's an official child poverty rate, and it's kind of for families making about $21,000 and under. It's sort of around there, but it doesn't take into account any of the means-tested government programs that people are able to get. So if you're making $20,000 a year and you have kids, if you get food stamps, Medicaid, housing, all those things, that does not count against you being in the poverty rate. It's just your income.
Yeah.
When you add those things into it and you go, okay, well, this person's making $20,000, but they're also receiving, you know, $35,000 worth of these various things or whatever the rate is, the actual child poverty rate in the United States is about 3%, maybe 4%. So we've done a good job, and a lot of that gains happened between 1996 and now. It used to be 16%. Now it's about 3.7. So I am kind of conflicted because I like cleaning it up and making it less bureaucratic.
Right.
On the other hand, I look at the numbers and I'm like, well, it did seem to be a good reform that we did in 96. And I will stop talking now. Andrea, go.
Okay, I have two questions. One is, the first one is, okay, the child poverty rate has gone down. And that sounds like it's largely because of these government policies, right? So food stamps, maybe rent help, whatever. Mini question, does that take into account that $21,000? Does that take into account cost of living? Because $21,000 goes a lot further in some parts of the country rather than others. And then second, I can't think of the question of whether or not we want to do this or go back to 96 or like undo what we changed in the bureaucracy and all that is like, what do we actually want to minimize, right? Do we want to minimize the percentage of children in poverty, or do we want to minimize the percentage of people on welfare? Because if we want to do the former, I think you're right that noticing that the change has taken place is great. But on the other hand, I also understand the argument that says like, right, but we should try to get people working. And I know that that's like wound up in a lot of deeper kind of COVID policies as well. My other question, and Kat, maybe you can help with this, is I got really hung up on that one point that you made, Heaton, early on, which is that it's $300 per month up until age six and $250 per month from 7 to 18. Don't kids get more expensive?
Yeah.
Not less? Like, they're going to eat more and they're going to break their legs and...
Well, I'm glad
whatever.
You
like, why does it go that way and why those numbers? That seems really weird to me.
I'm a parent, and I'm glad you brought that up because I'm, you know how, like, no matter what the benefit is, you always get mad. You get jealous of other people.
Yeah.
So I'm upset because my kids are now, my daughter just turned seven, so I don't get, like, I'm angry at these freeloaders who are getting $300 a month instead of $250.
Right.
But yeah.
Cap, do you get $250?
Well, no, we get less because it's prorated if your income's too much. So,
but you are getting money. You are getting money in this.
Let's all go around and say our income real fast.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I know. Yeah. I haven't been on $1 million listing yet.
I should note that it's not a hard cap at $75,000 and $150,000. It's just prorated after.
And just to get a little wonky,
quite a few people in America would get this to the tune of about $80 billion a year if we were to permanently implement this.
Could I work it out so that I could have a kid? Like, I'll adopt someone who's like 13. And then make a certain amount of money so the government has to send me like $1 a month. Like, is that
I think that is literally what would happen if you're, something like
just
that.
Just to explain it, just to, we had a child tax credit for a long time. This isn't like a new thing, but it used to be like when you did your taxes, you would count that money against your taxes.
It was a refund. Yeah.
It was a refund, right. So for people who didn't pay, poor people who didn't pay any taxes, I guess you couldn't, they would lose money because you couldn't get the full refund, you know, it was just up to a deductible. Right. So they did that. They changed it where they were giving you the money in advance. Also, they raised how much. It used to be like the Trump actually made it $2,000. That tax cut bill, $2,000 per kid, that was a raise. And then they raised it again to $3,000.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. Cap, do you have to prove you're spending it on your kids?
No. It's just like they're paying. It's actually, if you think about it, it's kind of a conservative idea because you're basically paying people to have children, right? Like we're trying to encourage. No, you don't have to prove what you pay it on. You're just paying it. I mean, obviously, I got a newsflash. Having children is expensive. So I've never figured out how much they
but
cost me a month.
But you're breaking even, right? It can't possibly cost more than $150 a month.
Well, if you have a job, if you're paying for daycare and stuff, no, it costs more than that. Sure. Food.
Heaton, I want you to speak on behalf of all of Europe. Doesn't Europe do this like times a million?
Basically giving childcare and things like that are very common in Europe. That's true. And also, Kaplan, I'm glad you pointed that out. One of the big sea changes that has happened with this is not just the increase in it, but as you point out, it used to be an earned child tax credit, which is to say that if you weren't earning any money, you didn't get anything from it. It was just that it was against what you're currently making, whereas now everybody gets it. So if you're making zero money, you're getting this off the top.
Right.
I don't know if I would call it conservative, because I don't think conservatives have ever wanted to try and cause poor people to have more kids by virtue of subsidizing.
Well, I just mean conservative in the sense that like there's sort of a progressive school thought because of the environment and everything that like we should stop having children, whereas conservatives want to have more they always say like America doesn't have enough population growth, we need more kids. So that's
and
what
they
I meant,
definitely like. Can't come from foreigners coming into the country,
right? Exactly. Exactly.
Conservative, when he says conservative, he means Mormons.
Well, I think that the conservative argument tends to be twofold against a broad welfare state. The first provision is that if you make it too robust, you risk having people just take kind of subsistence level checks and not getting engaged in the economy, and so you breed a kind of low level dependency that people don't come up out of. That's the first thing that they're worried about. The second thing that they're worried about is that you're apt to potentially incentivize families to split because. I think this is one of the things that actually came out of the 1996 reforms is because we had so many strings attached, we were trying to target it. We wanted to give it specifically to single parents and unwed mothers. But that creates a disincentive where you now don't want to get married because you will lose some of your benefits if you do so. So that tends to be the other really big conservative critique of a lot of these programs. However, I should note that I don't think that this particular one, the child tax credit, would so much do that because, again, it's $75,000 or $150,000. So it wouldn't mathematically make a difference to you here if you were married or not.
This all gets very, I feel like, 2008 American politics, whereas like, are we talking socially conservative or fiscally conservative? And I think Kaplan, you're
right. I mean, social conservatives.
Social conservatives. Because you see incentivizing marriage. I'm imagining like home ownership and those various tax incentives that come with that. And then having more kids. And if you look at the reactions to, the U.S. birth rates declined in the last year. I mean, it was the right that was freaking out about it, not the left, for all the environmental reasons just stated.
I, I actually missed out on that. Is that a thing now? Like the conservatives are worried about lack of population growth?
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, it's not good for economies, right? You know this, when you don't have population growth, I mean, when you have, like, in Japan and other countries that have had, like, no population growth in Western Europe, mm-hmm. like, one of the, well, so guy, a reason why we should have immigration, of course,
right.
to what Andrew
and
was saying.
And we would actually have net negative population growth were it not for immigration. So for, to just merely to maintain a population, you need to have a 2.1 birth rate. Or maybe 2.3. I think it's 2.1 birth rate per woman in order to maintain the population.
So, we're under
I guess that's two babies and a one-tenth of a baby that pollinates the rest of them.
Two babies and a dog.
Yes, exactly. And we would actually be below that threshold in the United States right now were it not for our very large immigration policy that's going on. But at the same time, on the flip side of the coin, like most of the arguments against overpopulation have basically been, look, as populations get more wealthy – they tend to have lower population and they tend to have fewer people that are being born into it, which means you don't really need to worry about these Malthusian delusions of everybody starving to death and, you know, living in giant ghettos, because the more the population becomes economically advanced, the more it's going to become smaller and easier to maintain a standard of living.
Can I want to bring up a question here. So to me, Andrea said that what are we worried about? Are we worried about kids not being in poverty, or are we worried about people going back to work? The other question in all this is, like, the economy as a whole in the country. So obviously, if people don't have enough money to feed their kids, then you have homeless people, like the homeless population goes up, the overall economy goes down, which is another, is frankly what, like, a lot of people are most worried about when they put these things in. And how is the economy, this is a genuine question, how is the economy done in the past year since we've had this $600 a month thing? And there's been, you know, obviously a lot of people lost their jobs, but then they pretty quickly started giving people enough money to live and exist and everything. And it seems to me like the economy's done, that's a big part of why the economy has done well during a pandemic when half the country lost their job. It's because they've now had, and then people are now, like, buying cars and going on vacations and buying houses and all this kind of stuff. And it's impossible, like, the housing price is going up, which is a sign that the economy is good. So how would this affect the overall economy?
I think there's three responses to that. The first one is I think there's pretty widespread consensus that the extreme anti-poverty relief measures that we did in 2020 were effective at curbing poverty. So generally speaking, you know, between the direct checks that people were having and expanding unemployment and so on and so forth, that kept people from becoming homeless, and it was a necessary curb against that. The second part is there is a very big debate as to whether or not having unemployment benefits that extend too long and are too great actually has a drag effect on the economy, because people would rather just stay home than go back to work.
So no comment on that.
Possibility.
Yeah.
But here's, can I push back for a second? This is like, okay, this is an argument, but how do we know until we try it? I mean, like, so far, frankly, like, what rich people care about is the stock market and their own money and their housing price going up. And if this is helping that, then this seems like it's something that could be good for everybody. And if these people never go back to work, I don't know, big deal. Like,
well, I think the fear is inflation could happen.
Why do we care? Just because it's unfair, because they're not working and I'm working. But they're clearly still making a lot less than you're making, right? If you have a good job and, like...
Well, you're talking about extending unemployment then, more stimulus.
I'm saying that this argument that, oh, well, if we keep giving them jobs, they won't go back to work. My question to that is, so what?
Mm. Well, I think the concern might be, and I share, Turner, the view that I think that you have, which is, like, I guess I don't care. You know, they're making that
I'm
choice.
Trying to figure out my own view, but
Yeah. Yeah, that's the most progressive thing I've ever heard you say. But
it's not on purpose.
Yeah. Just give people money. I don't care.
Yeah, why do I care if
he just cares about his stocks? He's like, my stocks are up.
Portfolio, baby.
And a lot of people are using.
Oh, sorry, is I mean, they're all going to invest in GameStop, so we're done. I think the argument is that businesses over the long term will suffer because they can't get enough workers. And maybe I'm being myopic here because I'm thinking of like New York restaurants can't hire enough busboys or whatever because people aren't interested in going back
to
work.
No, that is a nationwide problem. I know what you're saying.
No, the IHOP in Philadelphia yesterday basically closed half the restaurant because they don't have workers, they told me.
Right. So,
yeah.
So then the argument is like, is that worse for the economy long term, or is that a sign that maybe we need to pay our workers more? I mean, the left and the right have their own narratives around those as well. Right. But that could be where it affects the economy.
Yeah.
And but I think on top of that, unemployment, I've seen, I think of the various anti-poverty measures that we've taken, unemployment's probably been the one that's been the most abused over the last year and a half. So that's one where there are people that are, there are people that I know that are taking unemployment checks that are doing work on the side and so on and so forth. And so there is a little bit of that grasshopper ant phenomenon going on morally, but also just a concern to whether the money's actually being useful in a good way for that. So I think like the other bit too, which I don't think is as much of an issue with this particular welfare issue, is the idea of the welfare cliff. That's something that I'm very concerned with. So I brought it up on the program before, but there was a This American Life episode where they talked to a lady that was receiving some kind of means-tested money from the federal government because her son had a learning disability. She's very poor, and at one point she confides that she would love for her kid to do better in school, but if he does, they don't get that money anymore. Mm. So it's kind of in their interest for him to not do. So that kind of thing, I think, is emblematic of the welfare cliff. And that's one of the concerns with how you structure the welfare program, because if you make it so that if you earn any more money, you don't get any of these benefits you're currently getting, and you suddenly lose, in effect, $10,000 worth of resources available to you, people will rationally not do that. But it has the effect of trapping them at a low income level, which I think is something nice about the current child tax credit, because it wouldn't do that. And it doesn't seem to be enough to greatly disincentivize people from working.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say one of the things that I think could come out of this. So like right now, the fight is really just, do we just keep doing it or not? That's going to be the fight. The fight's going to be, do we make this a permanent feature of the American welfare state? Mitt Romney suggested that we potentially do that, but we also remove some of the other kind of bureaucratic means-tested type things. So instead of having both, we sort of shift it over into this non-specific, non-targeted phenomenon, which I think might be the way to go, in that you, rather than having a myriad complex system that's really, really difficult to navigate and these checks, you just focus on doing these checks and go that direction. So that's another possibility that we might do.
All right.
Is the hatred towards bureaucracy itself that it is wasteful of resources because it's expensive to carry out and time consuming to do? Or is it just like an aesthetic? Or
to me specifically, or to Mitt Romney? I guess I can answer both.
You can speak on behalf of Mitt Romney. I guess the third option is it's actually a barrier. This is what the left would say. One thing the left would say is it's a barrier to participating in these programs, because if it's really, really complicated, you're not actually taking advantage of it.
I think it's more hatred on all sides. I mean, I think on the right, it's a hatred that it wastes money on the fiscal right? And that on the left, I think it's a hatred for the people who are trying to apply for all these programs, that it's like so hard to do. You have to fill out all these papers. Sometimes the person doesn't get back to you. You have to wait forever, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, just give people money. Lots of money.
On top of that, too, like I'll say one of the things that really bugs me about a lot of the government aid programs that we have, I find end up being phenomenal for really canny upper middle class people that know how to abuse them and don't get used. So one of the things I do when I'm in Tulsa is I go on Thursdays, I volunteer under a bridge and help homeless people, and I pass out hamburgers and I clean up trash and things. And
look at you.
One of the big parts of it is just hanging out, talking to people. And one of the things that I have found really surprising is just how unaware of everybody at that level is of any of the things available to them. So like this one guy, he's a former bull rider. He got his teeth knocked out by a bull. And I was talking to him, and he was talking to me about how he was looking to save up money to buy dentures. And I was like, you know, have you talked to any of the services here in the city? Because that might be a thing we do. I don't know. And it just hadn't occurred to him to do it. And I walked over to a table and went, do we do this? And they went, oh, Catholic Charities actually has that. So there seems to be kind of a disconnect there a lot of the time, too, where I find that people that most need this stuff are oftentimes completely unaware of it. People that don't need it kind of know how to take advantage of it to, you know, supplement their income so that they can go to vacation to Italy. That's one of the things that bugs me.
This is very anecdotal, but when I was in grad school, there was a lot of talk of if you like, because you make no money in grad school, but it's still enough and you're in grad school. So you're doing fine, right? Typically. And a lot of people, like there were stories about people using food stamps to buy like really fancy cheeses and things like that at like the local co-op in Ann Arbor. Like, not all the stereotypes that you don't want.
But, I knew people in, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, for the guy under the bridge who wants dentures, I don't know that the barrier, you could get into the weeds on this particular case, is like, is the barrier the potential bureaucracy or the awareness full stop? And are those separate problems, right?
For him, I think it is so much better to just cut that guy a check. I think it's so much better for him to just get the money. And the potential for him is that he might, I don't think that particular guy that I know, but other people might have substance abuse problems. So it's possible that you're going to just be subsidizing that. For people that are not going to spend it on that, but also don't know the system very well, it would be much, much better just to give them a check.
Sounds good. Should we move on to the next one?
I think we should. I think thank you for indulging me on this one. I remain slightly conflicted on it, but I feel like we were able to wallow in it. So let's go on. Who wants to talk next?
I feel like mine is an amazing segue from what we just talked about. So okay. I'm going to nominate mine unless there are objections.
Go ahead. Take the lead.
We're talking child poverty. We're talking guy who can't get teeth. Now I want to talk about what the world's richest of the rich did during the pandemic.
Like you.
I feel like that's just as important and requires just as much of all of our collective energy. So I became very obsessed with what rich people were doing during the pandemic. And I also watched The Crown because I'm insufferable. And I got very interested in that island that Princess Margaret used to go to called Mustique. And I realized that you can go to it. You don't have to be a multi-billionaire to go. So last week and the week before, I was in the Caribbean. I went to St. Lucia first because I couldn't afford 2 weeks in Mustique. So I went to St. Lucia for a week, which is in the southeast of the Caribbean. And then Mustique, which is a private island owned by a company inside of a country called St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And that whole setup is insane because they just bought the island from the country. And then only super rich people go there and live in these massive villas like Mick Jagger and Brian Adams and all these David
Epstein,
Bowie used to go
Epstein
there.
Was Epstein there?
He may have been, yeah.
Yeah.
But they also have a one hotel. And the hotel has fancy residences and it has fancy rooms. And then it has three tiny cabins. So I stayed on the cabin in the hotel almost in the off season, which is basically I was the poorest person on the island save all the people working there. But I was there for 8 days and I basically
you were literally the only middle class consisted of Andrea. And
yes,
then there was
exactly.
The working class of the super rich.
It was and it's very British heavy, so Americans don't really know about it. Stop me if maybe you all do, but I hadn't heard of it until I started looking into it. Like Goop, that horrible website, had a big review of it. So that's
kind
of place we're dealing with. Okay. And I was just desperately curious to see what it was like. They also, you know, you can't get on the island if you don't have a negative COVID test within like a second before you step off and all this kind of stuff. And so it was, you know, no one wore masks. We all wandered around, et cetera. So I was very curious to see what it was like. And I had read in one of the articles I read for this podcast was about the fact that rich people were going there. And is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And generally speaking, everyone thought it was a pretty bad thing because during the pandemic, super rich people were like, all right. And they just went and lived in their, you know, 12 bedroom villas on this island that is not even really meant for living. Like they desalinate their own water, but other than that, they don't really grow anything or it's just like a rock in the middle of the ocean. So they have to get everything shipped. And that meant that they have like butlers and staff who were waiting on them literally hand and foot, which you could argue, well, they had jobs, but also, you know, colonialism, etc. So I went for many reasons, and one of them very selfishly was just wanting to get out of New York City. And my main takeaway is indeed colonialism is alive and well. I mean, the it was like just black people serving expensive things to really wealthy white people, and I expected it, but it's always a bit jarring to see. And two, rich people are just as bored as everyone else. And they do the exact same things. They just pay a ton more money for it. So the island would have these activities every day. And they'd be like, okay, Tuesday is happy hour. And Wednesday is live music night. And Thursday is taco night. And I would go to these things because it's literally one thing to do on the island. And it sucked. It was boring. It was small talk. it was just twice as expensive as anywhere else. The food was worse, and the people were wearing really expensive clothes. And that was it. So rich people were just
twice as expensive. Can I present the other point of view?
Please.
Isn't that good for then the workers who were there?
So that I don't know. And I wish I had a better sense of it. I don't know how much they get because the island is owned by a bunch of British people, I think. So I don't know what percentage of the income that goes from, say, the Cotton House Bar, which is the name of the hotel, which is worth thinking about anyway, how much of the income from that goes to the workers versus just the company.
That well, I'm delighted to hear that rich people are as bored as we were.
God, they were bored.
Pleases me.
Yeah.
I am far less bothered by just sort of the concept of inequality than I am of poverty. So this does not terribly, like, assuming that none of the people were captured a la the most dangerous game, I'm not really bothered by them going to the island or anything like that, but kind of pleased to know that they're not having a better time than me.
No, they really aren't. And I could be, you know, that I wasn't invited to the
Maybe
cool
they'd
parties,
invite but, you, yeah, secret clubs.
Yeah. But the things that I saw and was part of were unremarkable. It was no better than like obnoxious work drinks that I've gone to before where it's kind of small talk and you're kind of bored. And
I mean,
the one cool thing is that John Cleese was there and we had breakfast near each other.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. Oh, I was about to say, did you talk to him?
No. The whole thing is like you're not supposed to talk to people. This is a refuge for the rich and famous to not, you know.
So if you went up and talked to him, would they throw you off the island?
An autograph, that kind of thing.
Okay.
I went by Tommy Hilfiger's house, and it was very nice.
He's got somebody alerted me that John Cleese has a new documentary coming out on cancel culture, and that might be my opportunity to interview John Cleese. I just
that
have to figure out who his PR people are. And Andrea, if you just risked getting kicked off that island, maybe you could have co-hosted that particular episode with me by snaring John Cleese, but you didn't.
It was my last full day on the island. I should have just gone for it.
Have you guys ever done a show with Camilla Cleese? Do you know her?
No.
It's John Cleese's daughter is like a stand-up comedian, and you can't see me, but I'm doing quotation marks.
Got it.
in Los Angeles, and it's pretty rough. Let me just tell you that much.
What I'm hearing here is that if I'd stayed in Los Angeles, there's a chance I could marry into the Cleese dynasty. Is that right?
There is, yeah. I mean, you might want to bring it up. She's a
Maybe he'll set you up with his daughter.
Andrew Hugh Cleese has a good ring to it, I have to say.
Yeah, you know what? At the end of it, I'll be like, listen, I haven't even been recording this conversation. This is really just to figure out what the setup is of your daughter. And, you know I'm a good guy
Let's
now.
Just, in your best interest, then, I will not continue my review of her comedy set.
Yeah.
That's Patreon content. So yeah, the one thing I will say to derail Heaton's marriage plans is on the inequality versus poverty thing. I was thinking about that a lot, and I agree that inequality, fine. I had a professor in grad school who said something that I still don't have a good answer to, where he basically said, Heaton, what you said, which was, why is inequality on its own bad, provided that the lowest class or the lowest group or the lowest whatever is okay? Who cares as long as the lowest
Andrew,
people are
you
doing
just
fine.
Said that being rich sucks, so why do we care? Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. The middle class is where it's at, baby.
I don't know. I've never thought that they were having that much better of a time than anyone else anyway. I know that, like, Hollywood, I mean, like, TV and entertainment is built, and TMZ and everything's built to make us think that they're at some exclusive event that we would never, oh my God, if we ever got into it, would change our lives, it would be the best thing ever. Am I the only one who just never really bought into that?
I hadn't given it thought one way or the other. Like, I want to be clear that this isn't a place that I've aspired to go to for a long time. I think I just went insane during the pandemic, and it, like, jumped out to me as a place that you could go. I was like, all right, like, let's see. And so it's not like I watch these shows and I'm like, if only I could be the Paris Hilton of whatever, right? But it was more like I assumed it would be more different, and there would be, like, culturally things I didn't recognize, but it wasn't. The only thing that was really different...
I felt like there was going to be... Andrea, I felt like you were going to have a rejoinder to your professor about inequality, and we cut you off. Did you have additional thoughts on that?
Not really, which is to say that I think I want him to be wrong, because I have it in my head that inequality is bad. I think some level of inequality is healthy, but really extreme, and we talk about Bezos having billions of dollars and the rest of us not. Like I both agree with him that if we're all doing okay, who cares how high up it goes... but I also feel like there should be a mathematical or logical reason why inequality on its own, after a certain percentage, like the Gini index is off by some degree, is bad. Like, maybe it is bad for the economy long term, like what Turner brought up, or maybe it isn't self-sustaining, or maybe I don't know, but I just wish I had a good answer to him. And I literally was standing on this beautiful beach looking at, you know, the sunset and whatever, it's gorgeous, and I'm thinking about, his name is Bill Clark, he's now at Texas A&M. He was like, I was like, Bill might be right. Maybe it's not that bad. But the other thing I do want to say is that there's a ton of poverty on St. Vincent, the main island. I think the staff live in quite a lot of poverty. There's a tiny town called like Lovell Village or Lowell Village on Moustique, which is where the locals live. And there are like 40 Moustiquians total. Very few people are actually born there, but there's a school. And I went to the grocery store because I got sick of rich people food and I bought like a can of whatever. Everyone seemed much more poor. And St. Lucia, I went to the one of the big cities in the South, and it was among the worst poverty I've seen around the world. So it's not like the lower bound is doing great.
But, right. I think that's part of it, is the deal with capitalism is basically everybody gets wealthier. It's just that the wealthier get wealthy the fastest. That's the deal.
Maybe the goal should not be to get everyone equal. Maybe the goal should be everyone should be equally entertained. As long as everyone's equally, like everyone's bored the same amount should we shoot for. We're never going to get all the same amount of money.
The chips and guacamole and margarita that I had on Thursday night at Basil's Bar were among the worst chips and guacamole and margarita.
My God. So, you should write a negative review.
Write a Yelp review. I do think there's a couple of things that you
British
can add.
British guacamole is
yeah, terrible. No. That's a bad order by you. I don't know what you're doing.
Andrea, I think there's a couple of things you can add to your quiver. So I think you're always going to be against inequality, because I think that so many of the things that we dislike, and I am in this category, it's a visceral, intrinsic problem with it. And I think it probably has very deep evolutionary roots. So I don't think it's going to go away. I don't think that there's going to be much you can find that's inherently bad about inequality, just there being a gap. But I have heard pretty good arguments for people like me that really don't care. Again, I care about the floor. I just don't care about the gap. One of the arguments that does give me pause is, right, but if the gap is big enough, long enough, it destabilizes society because it breeds resentment, and it means that the people at the bottom might just rise up and burn it down. Even if the system's working well, they might just break everything. It might cause revolution, or alternately, it might breed so much discontent that people at the middle and the top have to live in gated communities with guards and that kind of thing. So that's a kind of a secondary practical consideration. The other thing that I'll add that I think that people like me of the neoliberal persuasion tend to leave out is we look at like something, I think it's Brink Lindsey's done good work on going, look, everybody in America's raised in terms of material comfort the last 50 years. And you can look at these wonderful, very good research on how, you know, the lowest quintile of the American population still has air conditioning, refrigerator, television, et cetera, et cetera. So when you're looking at just material comfort and access to material goods, actually everybody has gotten a lot better. But that's one way of looking at it, and it's a very good way of looking at it. But I think when people are envisioning the rich, they're not so much thinking about the stuff they're having as just the amount of control they have over their lives and the immediate environment around them. So if I have a refrigerator and air conditioning, all these wonderful things, modern dentistry, but I am so stressed because I have to be at work at 6:30 in the morning, and I don't have any other options beyond that. And I have to do all these things, and I have no control over my life. I have no control over the options that I have available to me. I feel like that is a different kind of thing that oftentimes gets left out of the equation.
But Heaton, I guess to add to that, it's, wasn't there a study done that once you make over, it's like $115,000 a year as a family, then that you do become more happy the more money you earn, up to like 115, or maybe it was 130,000 a year, and then it flattens off.
Yeah, there's diminishing returns. So the number changes periodically because of inflation and so on and so forth. But you're right. There is an identifiable trend of if you were poor to the point where you're worried about feeding your kids, you're probably unhappy.
Yes.
Right. Poverty, despite the fun movies we see with the scrappy village and everything, poverty tends to make people very sad.
And stressed and unhealthy. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. There comes a point, and I don't know what the number is anymore. Let's say it's 115,000. Where when you reach that point, it's almost like the units of happiness decline in In comparison to the amount of money you make. So yeah. you are getting happier, but it's much, much less happy. So let's say, throwing out numbers here, 115 being the benchmark, you're, for every $10,000 you're making until you get to 115,000, you're getting significantly happier because now you get to go on vacation and you get to, you know, all these things. And then at the 115,000 mark, you're a little happier, but it's not a whole lot. It's not very much. And at that point, it tends to, there's so many other things at that point that would make you much happier. If you're at that kind of economic equilibrium point, like there is wonderful data that came out about 10 years ago that joining a monthly club, like a book club or the Rotary Foundation or a garden club or whatever, a D&D group, whatever the group is about equal to $10,000 of a raise for you. For most people, if you're above the poverty line, that just your ability to be happy is actually a lot easier in terms of things available to you beyond income level. But yeah, definitely declines in terms of the marginal utility of it after a certain point.
So Heaton, I think we just solved the policy conundrum that you raised earlier, which is that we get people just above the poverty line, and then rather than give them money per kid, just force them to join a D&D group.
or sign up for our Patreon. Yeah, something like
but
that.
Turner, so I'm so glad you brought this up, Turner, about the money buying happiness. First, I thought the number was 75,000, not 115, so I obviously haven't been keeping up with inflation.
Yeah.
But maybe that was single parent, whatever. But I will say that another thought I had while I was on this, it's a gorgeous island, like one of the, maybe the most beautiful beaches I've ever seen in my whole life. I was like, you know what? Money might be able to buy happiness, or maybe I'm still below that cusp. We haven't gone around and said our incomes yet, but like I'm swimming in this beautiful ocean and I felt a lot better. Like I was like, oh, the rich people are boring, but I had a great time. My screen time was down. You know, I was healthier. I ate better, this, that. I slept great. And so money does buy a lot. And I spent a lot of money that week. So
yeah, but you can also just go on a hike. Yeah. If you want to reduce screen time, you know, people can do that for free.
I don't think so.
You gotta be near John Cleese. John Cleese inspires you to reduce screen time.
That's true. Yeah.
Turner, am I right that your story for us this week does kind of involve psychic utility and traffic and things like that, that we can kind of ride this train of things that make us unhappy?
Let's do it. So here's the thing.
That was a high five segue, by the way.
He's a pro. That's a real professional.
Yeah.
So what I want to dive into is this idea that because people are now telecommuting. Is telecommuting even the word anymore? Cyber
teleworking.
It's a very 1999 word, but I'm here for it.
What's the word you use? Virtual commuting? I don't know.
Remote
working
working
from home.
Remote working. Remote work. You take commuting out of it. All right, cool. The remote working, that it is, they're starting to have studies show that it's lowering traffic in major cities around America.
Sure.
The specific one I looked at, and this is early because it's, you know, the studies are now from like April, May, 2021. So it could be like people are just, maybe not everyone's back to work yet or whatever, but there is this idea that they're hopeful that it's going to be a long-term fix in a lot of cities to commuting, with the idea being that like not every car there reaches a tipping point in on freeways, highways, where if you put one extra car, it actually can create like an extra 2 minutes of traffic, and then the next car can create 5 minutes, for example, the next car 10 minutes. And so they've shown
nonlinearities,
like
baby.
For example, like in New York on like Jewish holidays, where just the Jewish people are staying home, the traffic's like dead, like gone. Oh. You know,
we're the problem once again. We cause traffic. Thanks a lot.
I actually had a Lyft driver say the exact same thing.
Well, Kaplan's doing his part here in staying home.
Yeah. Yes, so, exactly. I'm a good Jew. I'm one of the good
ones.
Yeah,
he's a good Jew. Keep being a good Jew. So then if that's the case, if this really bears out, then this could change how people live, where they live. Even if you're a commuter, even if you are going into work, you might say, well, I can now live 11 miles from the city instead of 6. And that could be like a 30-minute difference in traffic, what I'm saying.
Sure.
So... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, that'll be one of the great things to come out of the pandemic is that people will probably have more options in terms of working remotely, right? Like, not everybody will. It won't be across the board. But I didn't think I could do this show 100% remotely from a foreign country when I started it 2 years ago. And now I'm like, I could probably be over here for a couple of months and not really have any problem.
Kaplan and I barely see each other in person anymore. We do a podcast together 4 times a week.
I mean, it feels like I see you a lot, but yeah, it's a good point. And people with jobs, it's going to be, a divide though. Like, this is going to be the new, like, a class divide thing where people who are in management type jobs are never going to come in their offices. They're going to come in once a week to, you know, or have a meeting. But, and then the people in the lower ends though, I think are going to have to come back to work. They're going to make them do that. So it'll be interesting.
But either way, it'll be a more pleasant trip without traffic.
Either way, it's going to change traffic. You're right. And it's bad for the subways as far as raising money for public transportation and stuff like that. But yes.
Here's my question. Did anyone enjoy traffic?
Well, when you have great podcasts to listen to, you can make it enjoyable.
Yeah, content like this.
I didn't enjoy in New York City, we take the subway. Taking the subway in. But when I used to live in Sacramento and it was a drive commute, I drove like 45 minutes to go to high school. I actually enjoyed that time by myself. I understand it was terrible for the environment. Most people hated it. Maybe I'm an introvert in a certain sense. But I liked having 45 minutes a day each way to myself. But I might be in the, I'm sure I'm in the minority.
I definitely enjoyed being in a car more than being in the subway. Being in the subway for a variety of reasons was not super pleasant on a daily basis.
Yeah, one
of
the upshots to, and such.
Yeah. Well, no, you get on the subway, you never quite relax because you're surrounded by strangers. And then some guy tries to sell you one sock. Not two socks, mind you. One sock. And you're like, why are you selling me? Now I have to think about that. Now my day's been derailed.
What is that on?
By this half-priced one sock instead of two. And so, but when I'm driving by myself, like, I can sing as loud as I want, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, I recently heard Heaton sing for the first time. He has a great voice.
That's right. Andrea hung out with me at Marie's Crisis for like an hour or two, and you got to see me do some really good Don Quixote stuff when nobody was doing baritone. Yeah. And so it was great fun. Can I say this? It's not that I miss traffic. I do miss being in an office environment. I am very much an extrovert.
You're a blowhard. You love it.
I'm a blowhard. I thrive on people. I was out sightseeing yesterday and just kept stopping people to talk, like to pet their dog. But then I would just talk to them for 5 minutes, and it was I could tell that they were kind of thrown off by it, but I was loving it.
Such an American.
Such an extrovert. I have an ex-girlfriend that describes me as a Labrador retriever who hosts a game show, which I think is pretty spot on.
It is.
And I would love to figure out a way to continue doing this podcast, but to be back in an office environment for like 3 days a week.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's the Friars Club, isn't it?
That's
your office?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say something in defense of commuting on the subway, which is I have not taken the subway in ages, though I did finally take not just the subway, but the PATH train to New Jersey for a comedy show the other day. And it was the first time I've been on public transportation in like a year because I've been city biking and or staying home and or going to rich people islands. So I get on
the
subway.
Other than an airplane, yes.
Yeah. I get on the subway and I instantly, because there's barely any service, I instantly am bored. And first I look around and scowl at everyone on their phones and think, oh, we've all lost our ability to think independently. And then, of course, I get out my phone once I was done thinking about that. And I caught up on all these text messages that I never reply to text messages. And it got so much worse during the pandemic. And I cannot keep up. And I've just been a shit friend. Sorry, a bad friend. Mm-hmm. That's for Eric to deal with. But on the PATH train, while I had no service, I went through all these texts that I was behind on, lined them up to send. The minute I stepped out, they all sent. And I was like, that's what I used to do, is I used to keep up with my correspondence on the subway. And I don't have that anymore. And so I don't text my friends. And so apart from you three, I have no friends because I don't talk to them.
That's
thank God we're doing the podcast.
I know.
Well, but
so the commute was a time. So I prefer driving if I could, because Turner, I'm with you. I like sitting alone in a car. I think it's somehow 45 minutes on the open road versus 45 minutes in bumper to bumper traffic are two different experiences, largely, but maybe not. But I do think there's some value even to the subway in the crazy kind of way.
And you know what? The drive, I think going into work is terrible, but there is a great feeling when I used to drive of leaving your office, leaving your job and getting in a car. It's like a release, like a freedom, which you don't have when you're working
at home. When you work at home, it's really weird. You have to like walk around the block and like tap a lamppost and go, okay, I'm done. And then you go back to your house.
Also, like doing stand-up comedy, doing it on Zoom, and then you click off at 9, and at 9:01, you're sitting on your couch, and people are like, well, there's dishes left to be done. What are you?
People.
There's like no release time.
Yeah.
Right, you don't get to stop at the bar and have a drink, and it's like you're just home.
You want to be like cranking Tom Petty, roll the windows down, free falling on the highway driving home.
Yeah. Well, that's why I do like, and I'm just going to keep plugging stuff that Turner is involved in. But Turner, I like that on your Friday night shows, The Living Room, you at least hang out. It's only 5 minutes or whatever, but it makes it feel a little bit more social. It's like, all right, we all kind of say hi and bye for 5 minutes rather
than
Yes,
at the end, we
do.
We keep the we notice people like that. They would like want to talk, and we're like, oh, let's keep the cameras on. And sometimes it's 5 minutes, sometimes it's 10 minutes. It's never more than 10 minutes, but it does have a bit. And that's The Living Room Comedy Show. You can go to Living Room Comedy Show, NY.com every Friday
Turner,
night,
you can
PM
just
Eastern.
You can just keep Venmoing me.
Can I bring up one more thing about the remote working, which I think might become a thing?
Yeah.
So this I am not a labor attorney, so I could very much be wrong on this, but I suspect that companies are going to require people to come into the offices as we finish normalizing at least a couple of times a week for most employees. And the reason that I suspect that this is going to be the case is, in glancing at data, insofar as it's been available to me, there has been a gender breakdown in the United States and the United Kingdom in terms of who prefers to go to the office and who prefers to stay home. If ladies that have children prefer to work from home, guys that have children somewhat, but not as much.
Yeah, I can
and
answer
guys that.
That
don't have kids are happy to go back to the office, right? So insofar as this goes, this is no problem. People should be able to work wherever they want if they can, and like that's wonderful. But the concern that I think might bear out long-term from all of this is if those trends stay the same and single guys without kids are the ones that are mostly going to the office, I suspect by virtue of having that FaceTime with their bosses, they're also the most apt to get promoted, which means that there's going to be a kind of accidental sex favoritism that will go on qua demographics.
What about women without kids, though? Where would they?
Same thing, but they're statistically there are true. That would hold, but I think there's going to be, based on the data, there's going to be more guys than those women.
Yeah.
And so I think to avoid that and just to avoid the prospect of lawsuits, a lot of human resources departments are basically going to go, look, you have to come to the office twice a week, just because that's going to avoid a lot of unpleasantness down the road.
So I'm very glad you brought this up, Heaton. I will try to keep this short, but I do a lot of corporate training and whatever research around diversity and various barriers to it, sometimes on gender, sometimes on race, sometimes on whatever. But the gender one and maybe class and race to an extent, maybe nationality, but the gender one is huge on exactly that, where even in the pandemic now, where a lot of offices are saying, okay, you can start coming back, it's the men who are more likely coming back. Even if they a man and a woman both have kids, it's more likely that the father is going to go back. And it is leading to exactly that thing. And one of the things I do in my consulting work is I sit in on promotion conversations and help them like point out some biases and issues with how they're doing it. And they're already doing exactly what you're talking about, which is they'll say, well, this guy's already
prescient.
Back in the office.
He and for HR department.
Before Times version of that was like, this guy stays latest or he shows up earliest because he didn't have to go pick up his kids, whereas the wife had to or whatever, right? Because there's other gender dynamics going on. I will also self-promote a piece that a colleague of mine and I are working on that suggests that asynchronous work is actually much better for something called the credit assignment problem. The credit assignment problem is like you're a manager and you supervise a whole bunch of people and they lead to some great team success. How do you know who gets the credit for it? And the risk is exactly, Heaton, as you're describing, is that the person who's got the FaceTime or is there or is the loudest person in the room or sounds right or went to the right school is going to be the one where he obviously led the way, right? And so one argument for working from home and asynchronous work is you actually have a lot more written documentation of who did what. And you can actually see who's contributing to your team.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So in the same way that like when they're, I guess this is a bit of a stretch, but similarly to when they're figuring out who they're going to invite to an orchestra, they put a screen up so that they're just seeing the actual work rather than seeing whether it's a guy or a gal.
It's
or
the Masked Singer approach.
Yes, exactly. The Masked Singer is shockingly the most progressive.
It's the Pepsi Challenge.
Yeah.
So same kind of thing. If all of the work is via email and spreadsheets, then you're really just getting a better idea of the data that's happening rather than the personality and the biases that go into it.
To an extent, though, there was a great piece that came out. This was in the Before Times from a journalist at Quartz, and the title was something provocative, like Your Slack is Sexist, where basically you also get a written record of biased interactions, and you could see that male managers were much more responsive to their male direct reports posts on Slack than female. And so basically Slack, which was meant to be this like equalizer along the lines that you're describing, was simply just replicating this. So it's not so much that the input and the biases go away. It's that you'll have a written documentation of like, especially if you're asynchronous, not just online, you say, okay, I did these five things. Now I'm passing it over to you in Tokyo. You do these five things. Now you pass it back to me. And you actually have a log of who did what.
But you're saying only men do those things or something on Slack?
The Slack thing that came out was just that male managers were more responsive, attentive, inclined to comment on and respond to posts from male colleagues and male
directors. But isn't that...
Right, so you can quantify it. So you could basically go, Bob, we're looking at your data here, and it says that you're 30% more responsive to men than you are to women, and it says that you spend 60% more time talking to men than women. So basically being able to or accurately, however you want to look at it, it strikes me as Orwellian, but at the same time fascinating.
Exactly.
Your data is sexist, yeah.
Your Zoom was going to release a thing in the before times as well. I don't know if they have, of you could record how much people spoke in a meeting to get a sense of like, is this guy dominating the conversation? Is this person dominating? But asterisks around all of this. Sometimes you might talk to your male direct report, you know, on average, okay, there's probably something to be said, but on a case by case basis, maybe your male direct report happens to be the most prolific himself, which for maybe is related to other reasons, or is the person you respond to for reasons that are related to the business that makes sense, or this person dominates the meeting because they're the boss. So on a case-by-case basis, I don't know that you can necessarily infer that means that every single Slack is sexist, but I think it's the fact that on average it comes out that way is provocative, more so than a case-by-case anecdote.
Someone should make me a manager, by the way, because I would definitely talk to the women more. I never talk to any guys I work
with. That's the creepiest thing you've ever said.
Yeah, and he compliments them. He gives them fashion advice. He invites them over for special team-building activities at his
house.
Men
are boring.
Yeah. Kaplan, your last job, wasn't it mostly, if not all, women?
Yeah, my company was very, it was like, if anything, the discrimination was against men, but I don't want to get into that now. So.
Cap, should we go to the next one?
Yeah, let's end it on Cameron.
I think you need to round us up, yeah.
Yes. Well, it's an old story, but it's kind of relative to some things going on now that I chose. You know, with Jeff Bezos, when he went to the space, he got a lot of blowback. A lot of people were angry about it. But do you know the first living creature that ever went to space? Does anybody know the answer to this?
Is it Laika?
Yes, of course you knew. I didn't know this. It's Laika, a dog. I always thought it was like a monkey. I always thought like we sent monkeys up. The United States...
Communists couldn't afford monkeys. Yes, they could only afford dogs.
Yeah, exactly. So I think America sent monkeys up, but the communists, in honor of the 40th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, said they had to do something big. So they got brain trust together, I guess, and came up with this. They were going to send Sputnik 2. They were sending a dog up to space, right?
Mm-hmm.
And... So I was reading about it, and they knew right off the bat the dog wasn't going to live. So like this would be, and nobody was protesting this at the time. It was like, this is just how it was. And they gave her like one meal, you know, which I think was very interesting. A very classic example of like Soviet mismanagement.
Did she get to pick? Was this like death row?
No, but there was.
Multiple dogs of dog food bowls.
She gets an Eskimo pie or something.
Yeah.
Well, classic example of how women and men might be different and more sympathetic towards animals. A female technician went against protocol and fed the dog before they took off, which they weren't supposed to do. And I'm glad she did this because.
And the plane crashed?
The dog died within like the second they took off, like a few hours. Like they didn't even get to eat that one meal. And the Soviets lied for 9 days. They pretended the dog was alive on the news reports to the people. So they were playing like barking noises and
Weekend
stuff.
Weekend at Bernie's situation.
The original
dog had sunglasses on.
They should sue. They Weekend at Bernie's the dog in space. And so
I would watch
is that like their moon landing hoax where people at home were like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like a German retriever. That sounds like a dachshund. They faked it.
The funny thing is they picked this dog. So they picked this dog because she was very docile. I guess they didn't want like a dog that barks too much. You know, like my dog barks like crazy whenever there's a vacuum in the hallway. So they wouldn't pick her. But they actually had a second dog to bring us back to what we were just talking about. There was another dog that was supposed to go, and that dog had puppies right beforehand. So I guess it was like a show of like, well, the childless dog got penalized. You know, it's like
that's right.
They favor the woman in the workplace who's got to pick her kids up maybe and say. So they took the dog without the kids. They don't have a family. Sent her up there. And I just think this is the type of thing we should be teaching. I know it's a horrible story, but I think we should be teaching it in schools because we have a problem, Heaton, and I'm sure you agree with this, that a lot of young people, have a favorable opinion of communism now.
I do think
socialism.
That.
They don't know all the history. And they don't really care, though. A lot of people do not care about the economics opportunity and all the numbers you could give me about raising people out of poverty worldwide, all that stuff. Nobody cares about that. It doesn't speak to what they care about, the heart strings. But what they care about is dogs. So if you tell people that, because the American never did this, right?
The American communist really cares about dogs. That's very true, actually.
They they care about dogs more than humans, I believe.
Most of them are on Andrea's Island.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know people who were posting things on Facebook about rescue missions to get dogs out of Afghanistan. They weren't posting things about getting humans out of.
No humans.
Exactly.
I was actually okay. Last week, I hung out with a member of the House of Lords here in the United Kingdom, and that was one of the things that he brought up.
What a blowhard!
He was rather perturbed that everybody was more concerned about the dogs that were being called upon to be rescued from the from Afghanistan than the people that were over there. It was a topic that came up. Kaplan, I'm very much of your opinion. I think like the thing that I always get sucked into is people are like, "Yay, socialism!" And I'm like, and by that you mean nationalizing public services, and they're like, no, I mean sharing, and I'm like, oh god, I can't. Okay, from now on, just go, you know, they murdered dogs, right?
Well, I do want to draw a little line here that socialism and communism are not quite the same thing.
That is
so
true.
It could be the communists that are sending dogs to space, but I don't know about the socialists. Also, sidebar, can we please keep calling it Andrea's Island?
Andrea's Island is a great name for a reality show.
The new Epstein's Island.
The new episode. Say that.
Little, what are the big St. James?
I was thinking Gilligan's, but whatever. Okay, fine.
Kaplan, when next you were in Los Angeles, I'm going to say something nice about Los Angeles for a change.
Look at this.
It's bad for your brand.
I know. As ugly as Los Angeles is, I will say it does contain one of the finest museums in the United States, if not the world. It's called the Museum of Jurassic Technology.
Ooh.
I'm not going to spoil it for people, but if you're in Los Angeles, I would literally put that at the top of your itinerary.
Okay.
Don't go see a bunch of names jackhammered into a gutter. Don't see some letters they slung on a hill. Go to the Museum of Jurassic Technology. There is, at the second floor of the Museum of Jurassic Technology, an incredibly tasteful portraiture gallery of Soviet space dogs. And
really?
It's the weirdest thing. It's all these incredibly heroic-looking dogs looking up and to the left as if gazing into the future of a Marxist utopia. And it's just all the dogs that were blasted into space. Somebody made an art gallery of them and put them in this particular location.
Can I
that
ask
makes
a
sense
question?
Yeah.
Why did they have to put anything? Why did a living being have to be in there?
Right. They claimed that they had a test to see how living beings would deal with outer space. And they didn't want, obviously, to start with humans. I'm surprised they didn't
like
take someone in a gulag and just throw them up.
Yeah, prisoners. What about prisoners?
I'm surprised they didn't
Navalny,
do that.
Navalny, put him in space.
And they say that this was a success. I don't know how. They died immediately, but somehow this was a success. And then they said they gave it an award posthumously where they called this dog that it was an enduring symbol of sacrifice and human achievement, which is great because like the dog, I'm sure the dog appreciates that. Like she had no choice. It was a sacrifice.
Post-canously or something.
Yes.
Also,
good point. Yes.
If I were on death row, I think Turner's onto something because if I were on death row and it was like, all right, you get lethal injection, hanging, do we do that?
Or
I don't
a
know.
Rocket.
Or go to space. Maybe you'll make it and maybe you'll at least get to space before you explode. I would for sure.
You go down space. As the
first ever.
It would
almost incentivize murder.
I mean, I know there's a 1 out of 5 chance that when I wake up, it's 1,000 years later and the planet's been conquered by apes.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I get a new start. Maybe I become a human foreman. It's worth a shot.
And
we got you a one-way ticket to the moon, baby.
Yeah.
And one other thing I did know is because they didn't improve because they did have later dogs, I guess what Heaton's talking about, that did make it back alive. And one of the ones that came back alive actually produced puppies. And I guess the same way you think, like, you know, when a horse wins the Kentucky Derby, you want the offspring. So Khrushchev gave one of these puppies as a gift to John F. Kennedy. As like
the space puppy.
Nice. That might be why the Bay of Pigs didn't end the nuclear holocaust. I don't know. Nobody talks about that, but that space puppy might have brought us back from the brink. So yeah, it is a great idea. We should be sending who could Bezos take up with him next time to get people to be on his side? Like what would be
a really great gold retriever or something?
Yeah. I think
or to get the real socialist, it would have to be adopted from a shelter. Golden retriever probably doesn't fit that bill.
Yeah, because nobody says like you know how they say like with Bezos
it'd have to be a publicly run shelter. That would be the distinguishing characteristic, Andrea, of
it
a
has
socialist.
To be a mutt.
If it were a private charity, it's not
That's
socialist
right.
because
That's
it's
right.
a voluntary section of the
Heaton,
private community,
they don't
regardless
know that.
If there's a profit or not.
Yeah, they don't know that. That's a good point.
They don't know that.
I mean, and everybody says, you know, they say like, oh, how much Bezos it cost, like how much it, you know, they could have paid for. But nobody says that with the communist dog. You know, like how much could Soviets have paid for with this technology? So we should we need to educate people this way. That's how I'll wrap it up with that.
I was about to say Bezos should send really poor people up, but I was like, that's going to be not good. Don't do that.
Send people from your island, Andrea's island.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, I think we solved economics today.
Yeah,
right?
we covered a lot of ground. Good job, everybody. Shall we go around and make our various plugs?
Let's do it.
Sure.
Great. So I'm Andrew Heaton. I host The Political Orphanage, and I invite you all to come and check out the show. I also will say that while we will have a bonus episode on the Patreon feed this week, we also spent about half an hour just chatting and warming up prior to all of this that patrons are going to be able to listen to. We briefly got into Andrea being in a reality television show and sort of hinted at my sex life and at least travel stuff going on. So that was a lot of fun.
It's very juicy.
I will note, yes, exactly. And I will note also that Turner, who will make his own plugs here in a moment, and I are going to be doing a meetup in Tulsa on the 10th of September. I will give people more details on that. We'll go to a pub or a bar someplace. And then we're going to be doing a proper stand-up comedy show at an actual stand-up comedy club in Dallas on September 16th. Isn't that right, Turner?
That is right. We will be at Hyenas Comedy Club. You can go to my website, turnersparks.com, for tickets, or go directly to the to Hyena's website. I don't know the address, but you can Google it. It's the main club in Dallas, Texas. Heaton and I, it's a Thursday night. We're going to be co-headlining that show. We got a guy opening, and then Heaton and I are both doing full sets, and then we're going to hang out after with all you guys. So come out to that show. Also, Kaplan and I are hosts of the Lost in America podcast. We talk to comedians around the world about the global news events happening in their country. So news happens in a country, we don't understand it. We find a comedian who lives there. They explain it to us in the great manner that any comedian would. So it's funny, but also insightful. And usually it's pretty nonpartisan because comedians, for the most part, just tell you the truth. And this week we talked to Andy Curtin in Australia about the continued lockdown happening in Australia. They're looking at possibly 6 more months of lockdown.
They're in it for life.
God, that would be 2 full years.
Yeah, and they've been in.
They haven't had that
while.
Much lockdown since all of those felons arrived there.
Exactly, and then they're keeping people in. And it's like a real hard lockdown too. Like you go to jail if you break it. So subscribe
to Lost in America. Also, our Patreon page is patreon.com/LostInAmerica. Kaplan and I do a 30-minute podcast, straight comedy podcast about stuff going on in our lives 3 extra times a week. So make that your morning radio show on your commute. It's a half hour. It's perfect time for a commute. That's us. Mm.
Or as traffic. You walk between your bedroom and your other room.
Yeah, find some traffic somewhere.
Pacing like a trapped lion, indefinitely.
Exactly.
What about, Andrea, give us your plug.
Yes, well, first of all, I feel like, Heaton, we breezed over your book, Los Angeles is Hideous. I don't know if folks have read that. We just said Los Angeles is Ugly before, so there's that.
That's true. Yeah, for those of you that don't know, I have written a book. Oh, that's right, because this is going in everybody's. I am the best-selling poet of a book called Los Angeles is Hideous, Poems About an Ugly City. It became number one bestseller on Amazon in the category of poetry, which means that technically I am a more accomplished poet than I am comedian, pundit, or lover at this point in my life, but I'm willing to do that. Probably the funniest book about Los Angeles written this year, perhaps ever written, and I have found that people have really got a kick out of it, particularly people that have visited but not remained in Los Angeles.
I'm buying it for everyone I know. So, my name's Andrea. I am host of either Ask a Political Scientist. I'm either going to re-up for season 3 or do something else. If you listen to the bonus Patreon content, you'll hear my hand ringing over what to do. If you all have requests for podcasts, basically your options are more political science, complexity, data science, interdisciplinary. You tell me. I might just do the Andrea Jones Roy show and talk to people I think are cool. I also, if you are a listener and you are planning on being in Budapest, you can come see me perform the Data Acrobat on September 10th. And if you work for a corporation that I can't name because of an NDA, you'll see me give a keynote in a couple weeks.
Hey.
There we go. Hey.
All right. Great, everybody. Thank you so much. And have a good week.
Bye.
Bye.
Lost in America, lost in America, lost in America. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.